support comes from Tub Cove. With over 49 years of remodeling bathrooms, Tub Cove can help simplify the process, offering tub and shower replacements and full bathroom remodels. Local and family-owned, with a showroom in Redmond. Designs and information at tubcove.com.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. If, like me, you get a pit in your stomach and a thousand-yard stare when you think about all the things that could go badly during the 2024 election, hacks, foreign interference, deepfakes, you name it, then this segment is for you. Election officials in Washington state have long focused on the ease and accessibility of voting here. But after 2020, their emphasis has widened to include efforts to boost voter confidence and the security of elections. There's also been a push by AI researchers, including here in the Northwest, to build tools to keep up with the waves of synthetic media coming for our eyes and ears. More on that in just a few minutes. But first, for the latest on our state's recent moves on election safeguards, Jerry Kornfield is here. He's a reporter for the Washington State Standard, and he covered three new laws enacted this year to protect elections in Washington State. Hi, Jerry. Thanks for being back on the show.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for inviting me.
So first up, you report that it's going to get more costly to threaten an election worker in Washington State. Tell us about this new law. It's HB 1241.
We probably wouldn't even be talking about it if after 2020, the state elections director wasn't doxxed and threatened. And then we've had more recently, we had some envelopes with white powder received by election offices around the state last November's election. So what's happened is they passed a law that says it's now a Class C felony, which doesn't mean anything to most folks until you're convicted. And if you are convicted of that crime, you could spend up to 5 years in prison and maybe pay a $10,000 fine. Before that, if you had harassed an election official and got convicted, you would spend less than a year in jail. So the idea of more difficult, more a sharper punishment might deter some folks, but also a statement from lawmakers that, hey, the workers in our election offices around the state and the counties and the state are important to protecting and carrying out the act of democracy, which is the elections.
I know you talked with the bill's author, State Representative Mary Levitt of University Place, about some threats that have been going on against election workers. You know, an interesting element of this that you reported on, Jerry, is that election workers and family members will also be able to enroll in the state's address confidentiality program. Anything more on that that you can tell us about?
What's happened over the last few years, I know it's a term known as doxing. They've passed certain laws on this, too, where an individual becomes their home address, their place of work, information about their family gets picked up and shared publicly on social media. And then that individual becomes harassed. I did stories about a mayor in Snohomish County who was pushing for a law, and he was a former cop because his own family members got harassed after a very close election. So the idea here is, you know, try to, if they wish to, you know, keep that information private, they can sign up for the program. It won't change the work they do. They'll come to the office, but they can feel a little safer that people won't harass them, whether it's on social media or show up, you know, on their front door and harass them after an election.
Yeah, similar protections available for victims of domestic violence, stalking, and now election workers will be able to take advantage of that. Okay, Jerry, let's turn to the second bill that you covered, which is a little bit more complicated. It has to do with hacking threats to elections infrastructure. Set the stage for us here. There is this thing called an Albert sensor, and some counties did not like it. What happened here?
Well, I mean, the history, if we step back again, is that folks need to understand that the county elections are counting ballots and they're not hooked up to the internet. But it doesn't mean that someone around the country or in another country can't try to hack into the general county system and mess things up. And so these Albert sensors are intended to detect when someone is playing around in the background that shouldn't be playing around in the background. They're not going to be able to change the results, but they could change some of the coding for what gets mailed out, et cetera. Three counties on the east side of the state just didn't want to put them in. The state said, hey, look, this is just a device to make sure that if someone tries to mess around with your system, you'll know and we'll know. And now with this law, It says if you don't do it, we will be able to either certify results if you won't certify them, or we'll be able to make you use these things so because we want to protect against intrusion from hackers.
Yeah, they'll have to install these Albert sensors, which can tell when there's a nefarious, a known nefarious IP address that's trying to get into the network, kind of poking around.
They saw it as just the opposite, right? It's a conspiracy. These are folks who are trying to, we don't trust these sensors. We think this will let people in who shouldn't be in. So they had kind of a different viewpoint of what these devices would do and what information they would or would not shield against. So but now the state has made a statement that everybody uses them. We want to make you use them.
Yeah.
And when the results come in, some counties might, their answer would be, we're not going to certify the results because you made us use this device. Now the Secretary of State can go and say, well, then we'll count, we'll do it ourselves. We'll bypass you.
Yeah. I think it's a, one point to make. As you said, some counties were suspicious of these Albert sensors. In Lincoln County, one of the counties, Ferry and Grant being the other two that didn't want to use these, they were upset because they had a bad ransomware attack after an Albert sensor was installed. And so just kind of generally seeing, looking askance at these things. But again, as you say, this is the state saying we are setting a standard for what security looks like across counties for elections. And this law is going to end up meaning that these Albert sensors are in all the county infrastructure. Jerry, final law that we want to talk about here is about signature rejections. Basically, when a ballot is cast, but the signature on the envelope doesn't match the signature on file at the Secretary of State's office for a voter, that gets a ballot pulled out and flagged. The voter has to, go in and cure it. What is happening now with this new law related to voter signature rejections?
Let me first say that the bill and the law will not impact the election this year, but these changes will be put in. Some counties may have done it, but it'll just work for going into the 2026 election cycle. All of the changes that it envisions should be in place by then. The bottom line of this is people have their ballots rejected every election, and this is aimed at reducing the number. And one of the ways to do that is greater outreach and education efforts by counties. It also will involve in the next couple of years, the Secretary of State developing a sort of a uniform ballot envelope that every county can use. And then there's going to be information on them saying, look, if there's any question, your signature on this envelope will be checked against the signature we have on file when you first registered as a voter. And that's to alert folks who might, realize, hey, I don't sign the same way I did 20 years ago when I registered. So I should be ready for a phone call. When I get it, I'll understand what they want from me. I have to submit a new signature and I'm done. So it's really about just trying to reduce the number. It's geared all around the state for everybody to better understand why their ballot might be rejected for the simple reason of their signature.
Yeah, educational and looking at the design of those ballots, as you say, coming up in the next couple of years. Jerry, before we go, we have been talking about the ways that Washington State has tried to beef up election security, protect election workers, and help people understand better that process of curing their ballots. Up next, we're going to be turning to the issue of deepfakes in the election and what's being done to combat them. Before we go, what do you think is the number one thing that keeps election workers and election officials up at night at this point? What do you think is the biggest problem on the horizon for our elections?
I think there's two things that I think what keeps many of them up at night is just the idea that what they're doing, so many folks question, don't trust, where it wasn't an issue a generation ago. So they just have that know that what they're doing means something, even if a lot of people question the integrity of the process. And then the other, like you say, there are laws in this state on the deep fakes, and it just frustrated by how many people are out there trying to undermine and how many people are trying to mess with the system that has worked since we became a country. So I think that's probably it. It just, there's not really knowing a single threat, just knowing every day there's someone trying to mess with it.
Jerry Kornfield is a reporter at the Washington State Standard. Thanks, as always, Jerry, for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Those bad actors Jerry mentioned, they have a growing array of tools at their disposal to create disinformation. From image generators like Midjourney, OpenAI's DALL-E, Imagine with Meta AI, Google's Gemini, it's almost too many to count, to synthetic video creators on the way, including Sora and Google's Imagine, there's a flood of manipulated and fake content threatening to sow chaos into 2024's already heated political landscape. And while companies race for supremacy in the generative AI space, another set of academics, nonprofits, and private sector researchers are trying to keep up with tools to detect and flag deepfakes and other nefarious content before it can do serious damage. Dr. Oren Etzioni is the founder of TrueMedia.org and professor emeritus at the University of Washington. And True Media just launched a new deepfake detector tool for newsrooms to help stem the spread of disinformation. And when we caught up recently, I asked Oren the same question I put to reporter Jerry Kornfield. When it comes to the 2024 election cycle, what keeps you up at night?
In 2024, I am maniacally focused, laser focused on deepfakes. You know, say when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When I think about election security, I worry about disinformation in that context. So imagine that we're about to head to the polls and we find out that there's an active shooter. There's announcements on social media, pictures, maybe videos of people scurrying away. You hear gunshots. There's general mayhem. Now, in Seattle, maybe that, I mean, obviously it would be very unfortunate, but it might not change the results of the vote. But in a swing state where this happens in a polling station in a particularly blue or particularly red district, it could. So I am really worried about disinformation happening, particularly in the 48 or 24 hours leading up to the election.
Are deep fakes here, or are they still sort of the monster on the hill looming and lurching towards us, but not quite effectively causing chaos yet?
Well, both. Here's the sense in which they're here. 2024 is a very unique year. We've already seen elections in Taiwan, in Indonesia, in Pakistan, and in all these countries, various kinds of deepfakes have played a role, both disinformation. In the case of Pakistan, the leading opposition candidate was in jail, and his way of campaigning was actually by creating a deepfake of him based on notes that he sent in from jail. So it's definitely here. The sense in which it's the monster on the hill is that it has not created the kind of chaos that it could. So I think the impact could be a lot worse. But again, in a recent election in Slovakia, they have a blackout period on the candidates speaking to the press 48 hours before the election, and a deepfake audio was leaked, quote unquote leaked, right? Because it was fake during that quiet period, and it created a mayhem in that election. So this is to use the phrase, it's a real and present danger.
You have just released at True Media a tool to try to help stem this tide of synthetic content, manipulated images, deep fakes that we are going to be combating this year and onward. Tell us about the tool. How does it work?
Well, first and foremost, it's a free tool. So we are truemedia.org, emphasizing that it's a nonprofit. We don't charge for the tool. We don't intend to in the future. Also, it's nonpartisan. We don't espouse a political point of view. Obviously, many of us have our own. But our goal is to perform a technical assessment. When you see a video, audio, or image, was it faked? Was it manipulated by AI? And so the way it works, you get an account, and then you can either upload a media file that you've come across, like an image, or you can actually point it at a social media post on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, many of the places where people nowadays are getting their news and seeing some of these fakes. We do the analysis. We use both commercial vendors and our own models developed in academia. We're collaborating with colleagues at the University of Washington. We're using open source. We use as many tools as we can to assess what is quite difficult determination. Was this content, was this media manipulated by AI? And then we give you the feedback. We mark things as red if it's highly suspicious, yellow if we're uncertain, and green if it looks to be authentic. And we give you an explanation of how we came to that conclusion. And truth in advertising, I should say that our explanation is not as detailed as it might be otherwise, because we are trying to not reveal the sources and methods that we use to adversarial actors, to bad actors here.
So this isn't something that you want to go deep, you know, in the weeds on, obviously, because of what you just mentioned. But when it comes to detecting these things, technology for image generators and the, you know, synthetic video generators is starting to get so good that I think people may confidently say, oh, I could always spot a fake. But it's starting to get so close and so effective that it is really hard to do that with the naked eye. So what is, in a general sense, the type of technology that you're turning on this to be able to detect when something is fake?
That's a fantastic question. Let me address it in a second, but let me highlight what you said, because it's so true. It's a common perception that people say, oh, I can tell. And that's not the case. The New York Times and other places have done a wonderful job creating quizzes where they show you faces and they say, is this real? Is this fake? There's audio clips. And we very rapidly find out that you cannot tell. So I would caution people not to trust their instincts, because, as you said, it's gotten so good. Now, shifting to what we do, we use state-of-the-art AI tools to analyze the signal. Think of it as using good AI to fight bad AI. There's AI that's generating these sounds or these pictures or videos, and we have AI that analyzes what gets generated, looks at its statistical properties, looks at various regions. For example, if this is a video and the bad actor changed what the person is saying, we look at the lip motion, right? It's called lip syncing. And we see, do the lips look natural and normal? Does something look off there? When we're looking at images, we might look at blurry spots or at lighting effects. There's all kinds of little telltale signs that may not be obvious to the human eye, but that our algorithms, which of course are tireless and are analyzing every single pixel, every single dot in these images to assess whether they're fake or real.
Who do you hope signs up to use this deepfake detector?
First and foremost, we are reaching out to newsrooms, journalists, fact checkers. There are various organizations whose job is to continue to make sure that the content you see on Reuters, on AP News, elsewhere, is accurate, is bona fide. So we're reaching out to them. But we're really hoping that everybody lends a hand, in the sense that, again, to borrow a phrase, if you see something, say something, right? There's just so much that happens on TikTok, in Telegram, in Facebook groups that we don't have access to. We need to have people who are empowered when they see something that looks suspicious or that looks worrying, to have them take that social media post, analyze it, and post back into the discussion. TrueMedia.org says that this is highly suspicious. Take this into account.
Let's talk about the industry trying to police itself a little bit here, Oren, because we're hearing from groups like Microsoft, Google, Facebook. They've said, you know, we want to create this industry standard for labeling and watermarking synthetic content. And Facebook or Meta has started adding its own labels to AI-generated content, saying that it will remove posts from Facebook that aren't labeled. Do you think that the industry can handle this itself?
No. The road to hell is paved with good industry standards. Here's the problem. It's too slow a process, certainly for 2024. And while there are right-minded people at all these companies who genuinely care about these issues, there are also people whose job is to maximize profit for shareholders. So all these companies are conflicted. There's a deeper issue here, though, which is the following. Even if you have an industry standard that has what's called a watermark, basically all content that's generated by Microsoft or Google or OpenAI is labeled as fake if it's automatically generated by AI. Even if you have this, it has to be the case that as people consume the content through their browsers or through their Facebook app or what have you, that they're alerted that this is fake, that this is manipulated. And that's just not the case. People are not currently alerted to the absence of a watermark. And so or to the presence of the watermark. So they don't know. And then, of course, the watermarks are easily stripped away. So the bottom line is that this is not a practical solution to political deepfakes in 2024.
Or in last year, Governor Inslee signed a bill requiring clear disclosure of synthetic images, video, audio, things like that used in election-related media. That's for Washington State. What do you want to see from lawmakers nationwide on this issue?
We've seen very good initiatives in the states, including Washington, California, and elsewhere. Obviously, this is a national issue. And so I would like to see the best of these rules and regulations and laws propagate to the national level as soon as possible. And secondly, we have to augment the laws with tools to enforce the laws. So, for example, in the aftermath of the fake Biden robocall in New Hampshire, the FCC had a ruling on reminding people that these kind of fake robocalls are illegal. But if you can't rapidly and reliably detect these calls, detect that they're fake, then the law cannot be enforced. So I think that we need strong regulations at the national level, and they need to work hand in hand with the appropriate technologies.
Dr. Oren Etzioni is the founder of TrueMedia.org and a professor emeritus at the University of Washington. Is there anything else you want to add here, doctor, about what you're working on at True Media or what people should be on guard for as 2024 unfolds?
Unfortunately, there is no silver bullet. As good as our technology is, and as much as we're trying to improve it, it's still going to be a problem, which means that people need to be vigilant. When you see something, particularly something that you have an emotional response to, it's outrageous, it's jarring. How can he have done that? And you're ready to forward it to 1,000 of your friends or followers. That's exactly the time to take a moment and ask yourself, am I sure that this is bona fide? Do I know that this is real? There's no substitute for common sense and for a little bit of skepticism on everybody's part.
Yeah, is this a Pope in a puffy jacket all over again, everybody? Just ask yourself that. Dr. Oren Etzioni, the founder of TrueMedia.org, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. By the way, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's Teen Dance Ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.